What the world needs now is love, sweet love. It's the only thing that there's just too little of. What the world needs now is love, sweet love. No, not just for some, but for everyone. Lord, we don't need another mountain. There are mountains and hillsides enough to climb. Enough to cross, enough to last till the end of time. What the world needs now is love, sweet love. It's the only thing that there's just too little love. What the world for some, but for everyone. Lord, we don't need another meadow. There are cornfields and wheat fields enough to grow. There are sunbeams and moonbeams enough to shine. Oh, listen, Lord.
Welcome again, my friends, to the Ask Beauty Show. Today, for at least a part of the show, I think we need to all remember what happened 22 years ago. It's so hard to believe. The September 11 attacks, a series of airline hijackers and suicide attacks committed in 2001 by 19 militants associated with the Islamic extremist group, the Al-Qaeda, against targets in the United States, which was the deadliest terrorist attack on American soil in the United States history. The attacks, if you recall, against New York City and Washington, D.C., caused extensive death and destruction in all kinds of ways, not just physically, emotionally, psychologically, psychiatrically, and triggered an enormous U.S. effort to combat terrorism. Some 2,750 people were killed in New York, 184 at the Pentagon, and 40 in Pennsylvania, where one of the hijacked planes crashed into the ground after the passengers attempted to retake the plane. All 19 terrorists died. And again, if you remember, police and the fire departments in New York were especially hit hard. Hundreds rushed to the scene of the attacks, and more than 400 police officers and firefighters were actually killed. The September 11th attacks were precipitated in large part because Osama bin Laden, who was the leader of the militant Islamic organization Al-Qaeda, held naive beliefs about the United States in the run-up to the attacks. Abu Walid al-Masri, an Egyptian who was a bin Laden associate in Afghanistan in the 1980s and 90s, explained that in the years prior to the attacks, bin Laden became increasingly convinced that America was weak. He believed that the United States was much weaker than some of the other countries around him, and he masterminded. He referred to what happened to the United States in Beirut when the bombing of the Marines base led them to flee from Lebanon, referring to the destruction of the Marine barracks where in 1983, which killed 241 American servicemen. And bin Laden believed that the United States was a paper tiger, a belief shaped not just by America's departure from Lebanon following the Marine Barracks bombing, but also by the withdrawal of American forces from Somalia in 1993. I know this is a bit of a history lesson, not usually something that I do on the Ask Speedy Show, but following the deaths of 18 U.S. servicemen. Okay. So here we have it, 22 years ago. Do you remember where you were 22 years ago? Well, for me, I was in Sarasota, living in Sarasota. I remember it was an absolutely beautiful, beautiful, sunny, sunny morning, the beginning of September. And I got a phone call that I should turn on my television. And I have to tell you, I am not a TV person. I mean, I love movies on occasion, but I am not somebody who typically really ever turns on their television, certainly not in the morning. And I'll never forget it. I walked into my office and it was like, what's going on here? It was surreal. The planes, the flames, the bombings, the people on the ground. It was like, what is this? Is this a sci-fi movie or something like that? And a little while later, I received a phone call from my daughter, Jordana. She had been so excited to be attending New York University. She had been admitted to the Tisch School of Performing Arts. It was an absolute dream come true for her. And she said, Mom, guess what's happening here? She says, I was in the elevator going down to my classes, my first day of classes at NYU, and they're bombings. And I think I'm going to go out and I'm going to try and help people on the streets. And she said she just wanted to know and to let me know that she was safe. And all I can tell you from that experience, she and everybody that I know who was involved, either directly or indirectly, people who were hurt, people who were really trying to help in a variety of ways, there have been scars. There have been a lot of scars that have been left. And I sometimes wonder, when is enough enough? When are we in our personal lives, in our relationship lives, in our community lives, in world lives? When are we going to get to a place where it's not you against me, where there really is an embracing of togetherness and love? And I know some people who are listening right now, they're thinking, really? I mean, you know, this person is wrong and I am right. And yet this wrong, right feeling that so many people walk around with, I mean, how is it helping? How is it helping our personal relationships? How is it helping our political relationships? Whenever in our lives and in, you know, in lives that have, you know, preceded us, not other lives, but, you know, when has war, when has vengeance ever worked for the better good? And for those of you who are really tuning in right now and they're saying, is this really Beatty Cohn Bradis? Yes, it is really me. And for those of you who may be tuning in for the very first time, I am a psychotherapist and I am also a sex therapist. I'm an author of the groundbreaking book on relationships for better, for worse, forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love. And I'm giving you this little bio just so that you know that you are actually on the Ask Beatty Show, although this is not something that I typically talk about. I don't typically talk about what is going on politically in the world, although to be perfectly honest, I mean, how can we ever close our eyes and ask ourselves whether or not politics and racism and financial inequality, I mean, all of these things, whether we think it or whether we don't, they all affect us in one way or another. And I recently, because I'm also the advice columnist for Dance Papers in the Hamptons, I recently wrote a piece that's actually going to be in the magazine in a couple of weeks, entitled Strategies for Increasing Happiness in Our Lives, despite the turmoil that so many people experience personally at work and also politically. And it really does. It seems that we are bombarded with never-ending news stories alerting us to this or that depressing issue, from our political polarized unrest to our increasing economic inequality, from the mental health and opiate crisis to the rise of substance abuse and obesity and childhood suicide rates, unemployment, increasingly destructive wars that actually never help people ever. Our continuing battles with racism and mass shootings and domestic violence. The list seems endless, and it is so understandable why so many people walk around feeling stressed and feeling depressed. One in five adults in the United States in 2021 went without needed medical care because of costs and struggle to afford basic necessities such as clothing, housing, and food. And news reporters are not in some sort of conspiracy about these issues to sell papers. I constantly hear from patients and friends and colleagues how stressed they are. And even though America is the richest country in the world with an overall net worth of $145.8 trillion and a GDP of $25.46 trillion, in 2021, one in five adults went without needed medical care because of costs and struggle to find basic necessities as clothing, housing, and food. And we pay the price in many, many ways. I mean, Americans continue to struggle and suffer emotionally, psychologically, and physically in numerous ways as well. And not surprisingly, we become a country that is increasingly unhappy. But what I decided to do very recently was to take a look, to do a little bit of research and see whether there are countries and societies that are doing much better, where people are living longer and more happily than Americans. And I wanted to find out, what are they doing and how are they living and what can we learn from them? Despite the wars, despite the mass shootings, despite the income inequality and the domestic violence and the racism. And the one common denominator was that these countries, and the countries, by the way, Finland is considered to be the world's happiest country according to the World Happiness Report rankings. And the Nordic country and its neighbors, Denmark, Iceland, Sweden, and Norway, also score very, very high. So what is it? What is it that they are doing that we can learn from them? Well, apparently, these countries and these people have figured out that the way to live is not only to love and to love each other, but to have a life of purpose, so that it's not just about me, it's not just about winning, it's not just about power, it's not just about money, because these things will never, never, never in the end bring the kind of happiness that maybe Madison Avenue hopes to convince us that it actually will. And again, what is so important, and I don't think we talk about it enough, is how to create love, how to create loving relationships within our own family, within our own personal little world, and how to do this politically as well around the world. Well, I have a guest, and this is one of his areas of specialization. My guest today is my husband, Jim Freddos, who is a sociologist and a criminologist, and he is host of the Radical Imagination on MNN TV. It plays on numerous different channels. You have to check out when the Radical Imagination television show is on. It's also going to be beginning in the Hamptons. So for those of you who happen to have a television and access to the Hamptons, you're going to be able to hear not only the Radical Imagination, but a new show that is going to be looking at really what's going on, what the people in the Hamptons are doing and thinking, the local people. And most recently, Jim's show, The Radical Imagination, is now airing on the Progressive Radio Network every Thursday morning from 10 to 11 o'clock in the morning. So that's quite an intro.
Thank you. Thank you. Wow. That's maybe I'm going to be on too much. I don't know. But no, listen, I enjoy being on your show. It's wonderful to be here again. And I understand we want to talk a bit about 9/11 and what's been going on here in terms of.
And want to talk really, yes, and really want to talk about vengeance, how vengeance simply doesn't work. And when are we going to learn about the importance of people in personal relationships, working relationships, political relationships, where our goal is a win-win resolution? I talk about this all the time in my therapy with couples and with families. And yet this win-lose mentality, Jim, it's pervasive. You know, and of course, in talking about 9/11, I mean, it was a win-lose goal that bin Laden had.
Well, yeah, I don't know if I would use necessarily win-lose. I think they're basically all losers,
right,
including us.
Right.
And right. I think after the tragedy of 9/11, World Trade Center hitting New York, and we've both of us know people who were killed and who were nearby and so on and saw it. One thing that happened or could have happened is a sense of international community that developed and concern and identification and love pouring out to those who had lost their lives and to America as a country, as a culture. And you know, little background to this too is that bin Laden mentioned that you talked about, again, retribution and revenge, that bin Laden saw this in part as retaliation for going back to the 7th century, to the Crusades, and the disrespect and humiliation in the wars that had been, sent to various Arab countries, and the colonization that had developed in that in the Muslim world, and so on. So this idea of payback and retaliation, the eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth business, we became part of that again in our response and reaction to what the tragedy that hit us here in New York, and we hit back. To a country, right, that wasn't even involved in the actual action. And we ended up going through a war in Iraq and in Afghanistan and different other parts of the area. And tens of thousands of people lost their lives. They were injured. They brought back additional traumas that were affected. All kinds of people individually, culturally, community-wise, family-wise, and just goes on and on and on. So you're absolutely right. We need to find ways of stopping that pattern.
Well, I mean, the thing is, of course, is that these are not just political issues. As a psychotherapist and sex therapist, I mean, one of the things that I hear continually in therapy, at least when people are beginning, is that they need to be right. I need to win the argument. And this idea, and it is really reinforced in all kinds of ways. You're a winner or you're a loser, right? And the idea of trying to help people, and of course, and politicians and countries, and that's a much more massive task than certainly I tackle on a day-to-day basis, is that the ideal way to live, the ideal way to be able to experience happiness in one's life, politically, in the workplace, and at home, is to come up with win-win resolutions and to somehow find ways to convince people that that's the way, that's the best possible way to survive and to be able to live lives of happiness and inner peace.
Well, I think we're talking about the same dynamics, whether it's an individual interaction here or a larger collective or political one. It's again, rooted in such ideas of American exceptionalism that somehow, God is on our side. We are the chosen ones that are carrying forth. And that, again, we need to be number one. And I think that sort of thinking really destroys a sense of love and community that you're talking about here. I think we do need a change in that sort of vision and that sort of belief system. It's very difficult. It comes out in economic ways. It comes out in political ways, intellectual ways, moral ways, and it affects each and every one of us in individual, personal, family ways, that there's got to be this ultimate winner. And we're going to go to the mat until we show people that we are the boss. And yet we don't also, very importantly, understand the role we play in maintaining and keeping this very destructive pattern going. There is an element of truth. This is not trying to blame. There's blame enough to go around. There are policies that have created the situation where people, for example, are forced to migrate. And we have done that in this country. And then we go ahead and look at these people and say they are our enemies and they're vile and evil people coming up to destroy us and so on. And instead, understand our part in creating this situation. And I think if we start there and begin to look at ourselves and our role in that, we'll make a lot more progress than we have been doing.
You know what's, and I totally agree. I mean, I think that there's so much talk, right, mm-hmm. about therapy and healing and healers and love and community, and yet somehow we're really, really falling short. I mean, churches, synagogues, mosques, I mean, that's the message, right? To love oneself, to love one's brother, to love the world. And yet, what is it? What is it that seems to be operating where we can't seem to get beyond them and us and win and lose?
Well, because unfortunately, in my opinion, a great number of the religious institutions and organizations and established religions, whatever they may be, are hypocrites, and they're paying lip service to that. And they are in it for their own business reasons and for their own power and their own glorification and so on. And instead of seeing this as a really universal message and acting on it in the way that the scriptures, particularly as we know from the readings of the Hebrew scriptures, the prophetic tradition, and carrying on into the Christian message, Christ, who after all was a rabbi, an Orthodox rabbi, who preached, came here really to also speak for the needs and beliefs and standing with the people who are most hurt and most exploited and so on. He died on the cross next to common robbers and so on. And so he identified with the poor. And he again took the money changers to task for not doing their part, and that would be our Wall Street today. And he was right. And that prophetic tradition simply is not being followed. Greed is the religion, and let's just call it for what it is. Now we're beginning to ratchet up a campaign that includes people like Cornel West and Michelle Williamson and Bobby Kennedy Jr., who are opening up that dialogue. And that is, again, a real start at possible salvation and healing.
Well, yeah, I mean, I agree with you, of course, 1,000%. And yet, just to add to that, as the psychotherapist here, that it all really, in so many ways, begins in one's family. Now, in a couple of weeks, and I am so excited, my guest is going to be Dr. Nina Serfolio. Mm-hmm. Now, Dr. Nina Serfolio is someone who I just met, really connected with her. She is a psychiatrist. She has been a psychiatrist for many, many, many years. And has just come out with a book, which, of course, I know you're meeting with her and you're going to have her on your show. And
I'm cutting ahead of you a little bit. I'm meeting her for lunch with our psychiatrist friend, James Gilligan.
Right.
Talking about many of the things you're going to be talking about. So absolutely, psychiatry and therapy is an integral part in transforming the narrative.
And what was so interesting is I met her last week, and, you know, oftentimes I don't have an opportunity to meet upcoming guests. They live in different cities, but we started to email, and there was something really special about her, which is why, of course, I wanted you to meet her. And one of the things that she told me, you know, we were having some water at Nordstrom's last week. She told me about Putin. And we were talking about mass shooters and what is it? What is it about these people who are going into the schools and killing? And what is it about the Bin Ladens? And what is it about all these people whose ammo just seems to be violence? We're going to get you. We're going to win and you're going to lose. And she started to talk about Putin. Now, I knew nothing about Putin, had never thought about Putin's, you know, family of origin or his family history. We'll talk about a family of origin of abuse and violence and disconnect. She went on and on. And of course, all of this is in her book. And what she was telling me was that in looking at the psychological psychiatric profiles of the mass shooters, that again, it all begins in the beginning, and that the majority, and she'll be able to fill us in on all the statistics, came from extremely abusive homes and neglectful homes.
Well, absolutely, absolutely. But in the case of Putin also, I believe he was raised by a very, very religious mother in Russian Orthodox Church. But again, that's just an aside. But I would add, as Nina does as well, the historical cultural context under which he is being brought up, which has been geared toward an authoritarian, totalitarian mindset, the need for the so-called strongman dictatorship, that Russian culture from the czarist days on have promoted. And you and I know this, and I know this as well, of course, because our people came from Russia, or there's more from Poland, I guess, but mine experienced that and saw what the Tsar was doing to his people. So this is a long tradition within which, yes, you're absolutely right about the individual family, but it's within a social, cultural, political context that he was raised to. And he is acting out now in this craziness, this brutality, Ukraine, within the same mindset that he was raised as a kid.
Well, this is exactly the thing, Jim, that I talk about, and I know that you probably sick about hearing me talk about this all the time, but I want my listeners to know, I want people to know that we need to be willing. And I have found that most people are not, even people who oftentimes come into therapy with me. We need to be willing to try as best as we can to deal with our unfinished business and what I call our skeletons in the closet. We can't change history. We can't change anything that happened 1 second ago. But unless we are willing to, with a skilled person, and all therapists and not healers and not doctors and psychiatrists are certainly not the same. And of course, you've heard me and people have heard me say that I have a real issue with American mental health on all kinds of levels, including lack of access. But those old skeletons in the closet, they get replayed. And Dr. Nina was saying exactly the same thing. And there was much more to Putin's family of origin traumas, multiple traumas and dislocations, and his parents didn't want him, and he had to live here and he had to live there. So there were many things going on. And for all of us who've experienced traumas of various different kinds, we need to try to find ways to sort through them so that we don't repeat the history, the dysfunctional, the hurtful, the abusive history that may have unfortunately happened to us, which is not our fault, of course, within our own families of origin.
Well, yeah, just go back again to Putin for a minute. He's probably too far gone, although Jim Gilligan, in his understanding, is no person is beyond redemption. But to reach him at that level that you're talking about and deal with his past traumas is probably not going to happen. However, what's important is how we as a society, as we as a community, as we as people, respond to people who are hurt. And this is my point. I think it would be really, really helpful if we as a country began to put forward the sort of healing process through a ceasefire, negotiated settlements, a fair attempt to bridge the gap of suspicions and to build a trust up again in a variety of small ways, starting at first. And instead, what we have done is accelerated the violence in this particular war, which only makes Putin harder. And more, he's going to send more Russians to die, more Ukrainians will die. And there we have it. The bitterness goes even deeper. And you're absolutely right. Can you imagine, it's mind-boggling, the number of very good therapists that are going to be needed to handle just a fraction of the survivors, which, of course, you're not going to have. So I'm agreeing with you. It's absolutely necessary, but we can do things collectively. And we first have to understand our part, our role. Listen to what people are confused about, angry about, and try to come up with nonviolent ways of bringing people together.
Well, is this not what the restorative justice, I'm going to call it a movement, I mean, is really all about? Trying to bring people who have hurt others in some abominable ways, right, together. That's, say, the perpetrators and the victims coming together to try to find a playing field where they can talk with each other. But, you know, Jim, what I have found over, you know, the past 35 years plus as a psychotherapist, you know, sex therapist, is that you can't force people to do this. You can't force people to do the work. All we can do is encourage and encourage and encourage. I mean, do you actually feel, let me just ask you this, okay, do you feel that it would have been possible for anyone to have had a conversation with Bin Laden, okay, before these horrible attacks that happened on 9/11 22 years ago, to sit down and try and negotiate something and come up with a win-win resolution?
Well, yeah, sure. Any of our adversaries or our enemies, then start out that way. And there's all kinds of issues. He was trained by the CIA. He was our guy in Afghanistan. We supported him then. So we propped him up when he didn't serve our purposes when he developed a level of consciousness that got him to be our enemy, then we, you know, pushed him under the bus and tried to go after him and so on. So yeah, there are, it's a very important point you're making. There are points where people can intervene and interject themselves. For example, now with the Ukraine war, stop adding to the violence by not supplying more weaponry. Don't get more countries involved in this, because we're going to end up in some sort of nuclear confrontation. So yes, this can be handled at different levels of times or in conflict. Unfortunately, as you're pointing out, many of us don't even think of that until it's too late, or until the conflict becomes so violent and so terrible and destructive, then maybe we pull back from the abyss. So I think, yes, we can talk to people. Because what we're doing by killing bin Laden and his followers and the kids and bombing these different areas, and we are creating a new generation of terrorists. Mm-hmm. And that goes for all around the world. The Israelis, they're never going to be able to control and the situation there among the Palestinians. And the Palestinians have to understand they're not going to push the Israelis into the sea.
But it's our need somehow. Now, it's one thing, of course, about having a need to win on the tennis courts and a former competitive player in Canada. I mean, for me, winning on the courts, that's why I'm out there, of course, to have fun. But it's a different kind of thing. But yet this mentality of win-lose is really, really pervasive. And somehow we have to find a way. And I think that, you know, if people aren't lucky enough to grow up in families with this kind of mindset and this kind of philosophy and, of course, behavior is demonstrated, we have an opportunity in the schools. We had to teach kids about the importance of love, and what love really means is that it's not just a word, it's not just about loving bubblegum, but what it means to actually embrace and love your fellow person, even if you don't agree with them, even if you share zero values, that they're still a human being and that we need to be creative and we need to be mindful, but we also need to want to.
But also, I think you're making a very important point, the win-win business. We need to see that when Black Lives Matter, all lives matter.
Right.
So when we do have, we don't restrict voter registration and voting patterns within the Black community, that helps us all, except for some of those who benefit from dividing and conquering us and pitting us against each other. So I think we really have to see this as we're all in this together. We have to think more internationally that, yes, we are our brother's keeper. What does that mean?
Right.
That means that our brothers really should have really the same access or a similar access as possible to the opportunities. You know, I was reminded when you were talking about the win-win situation and not being pitted against it. As a kid, I was it, as you know, it was an Israeli kibbutz. And I remember I was on a John Deere tractor going down the cotton fields, spraying and so on. And I noticed all the American kids that were there finished their row of spraying or whatever, and they sat down. They said, okay, good. We won. We finished. And all the Israelis were picking up, said, well, we'll help who's ever lagging behind.
Right.
And that's what you're talking about with the Nordic countries. We need to have much more of that. And I think that's the step. And I think you do try to do that in therapy, too. You bring people together, families together, see where you can make sense of things, see where each other is hurting, which each member is hurting each other or did in the past, and start there and start ending the blame and starting new ways of relating and narrating and to save all of us. And within the family or whatever collectivity you're talking about.
No, I know, absolutely. And maybe again, and I don't think that Madison Avenue is necessarily going to be interested in any of this, but to let people know, I mean, everybody wants to be happy. Everybody wants to feel successful. Everybody wants to walk around with a sense of fulfillment and joy and inner peace. And maybe what we need to do, because I was just thinking about this right now, to let people know that the recipe for this, that the actual recipe for this, and as a non-cooker, I don't know too much about recipes, but to let people know that in order to be able to get all these things in their lives, they need to embrace a mindset of we, of community, and of win-win. And coming together, despite differences, you know, whether you have, believe you're a Democrat or a Republican or an independent, or whether or not, you know, you've been afraid of African Americans or Muslims, whatever it is, to let them know if you want to be happy, and get some of the things that you talk about being so important. The recipe is coming together and trying to discuss, in trying to negotiate, in being willing to make some compromises leading to the win-win resolution.
Absolutely. But I don't want to be a Debbie Downer here, but harsh and brutal reality is Madison Avenue, Wall Street, a capitalistic economic system is above all else. It's about profits, money. Nobody should make any mistake in not thinking that. So yes, you may get a diversity of commercials here and there and they're kinder, gentler.
Which we have.
They're doing that. But it's only because they realize they're pushed to the point, but that doesn't necessarily change anything fundamentally, structurally. It's still about them making money.
But look at what's happened, though. If you talk about, you know, commercials with the diversity of commercials. In fact, I saw the first commercial, Jim, last week that I ever saw with two men who were in really tight, tight spandex bathing suits, kissing and embracing each other.
We saw the show together.
Yeah, so. Never would have said that. Now, whether you like it or you don't like it, you know, for me, the message was, you know, whether it's about money, and I'm sure you're absolutely right, trying to educate people that this is okay. Let's put away
our
judgments.
Yeah, but you know what else is okay? What they're doing, and also that I'm sure they've done this study after study, and whatever they do to prepare to make these commercials, they made a very, very serious business decision that whoever is listening to this show would be more appealing. That would sell to that group that they're dealing with. I don't know what show. Maybe it was the tennis thing. I don't know. But not to the other part of America that would be so turned off by this. But so they calculate this.
Oh, no, you're absolutely right. But I think that it probably doesn't matter. The fact that years ago we never saw gay men.
What does it matter?
Their reason for wanting to do it. Of course, their reason is profit. But I don't think that matters so much. I think the fact that we're seeing gay men and gay women and trans and all the various different non-binary and variations, that we're able to actually watch this and hear this in the media, hopefully okay, it's going to get people to think that this is a more normalized way to live, which I hope that's going to happen, not to be so frightened, not to be so turned off, maybe to be
it's
a little educated.
It's a huge change. I don't know how huge, but it's an incremental one.
We saw gay people in commercials.
Right.
Or so many blacks.
Now, this is area of identity politics, whether it's gay, hetero, women, Jews, whoever is there has to have that vision of inclusivity and creating this environment of radical change. And as Cornell puts it, bringing justice, justice is what love is on the streets in terms of concrete policies. So that's also the bottom line for me, as I see it, and the influence that can bring about this sort of change is, at this point, largely through the social movements of the people we're talking about here, who hopefully then will be able to understand it's not just about individuals making it to commercials or even individual making it to the presidency. It doesn't do us any good if that person is still a person that is waging war and is right. So that's what we need for true transformation. It's going to take a while, but we don't have that much time. And that's why I'm fully endorsing and behind Cornell's message. And Bobby Kennedy has parts of it too, and Michelle Williamson too. So that's the struggle. Even though it's a very, very long struggle for any one of the people I just mentioned, because again, the two-party system that we have now is so wedded to the same interests fundamentally. Yes, there are differences. There are differences between Biden and Trump, but when it comes down to it, it's the same old, same old.
Well, so I guess the multi-million, trillion-dollar question is that when we get somebody into office who supposedly, you know, cares about people and over and above money and politics, what they're then going to actually be able to do, how they are going to then be able to approach and negotiate and discuss with people whose agendas are very, very different.
That happens in therapy too.
Absolutely. It happens
at the individual level. Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you have to negotiate, and sometimes people are going to have to agree to disagree.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the resolution, that the resolution is going to be really a non kind of a real substantial resolution.
At that moment, there may not be the sort of change that you can really want.
Exactly.
But you're also moving toward it. You're right.
You try, but people have to be willing to sit down. To sit down at the table and be willing to listen and to be willing to hear another person's point of view, whether it's a political point of view or any other kind of view, and hear and take it in, as I always say, where they don't feel, you know, that they're compromising all their great moral values or whatever. But then if the message was more, if we do A, B, C, and D, which means loving and win-win, that we ourselves as individuals and families are going to then be able to live a happier life. I think that we don't hear that message very often. We hear win-lose.
And we hear, and we're just inundated with the media and with violence and not ways of preventing it and going forward and learning how to negotiate, communicate. And you know, as we're talking here, I'm thinking of how when Cornell was down at Charlottesville there and the protests, the Proud Boys and neo-fascists. And again, the marching, the signs reading, "We will not be replaced." So yes, one has to reach out to even those people, because
especially those people.
They have been traumatized in ways, and you have to understand where they're coming from. And they're in our opinion, of course, they're displacing it on Jews or Blacks or whoever. In a false, distorted way.
Well, I think the real challenge, and I made a promise to an Alex who was on the phone, and I'm going to have to take his call before the end of the show. But I think the challenge really is, Jim, is encouraging and getting people with diametrically different beliefs and differences about everything to at least be willing to sit down and talk, and that in the process that maybe something really wonderful, like a loving relationship with someone who you never dreamt you could have a loving relationship with, you know, is going to happen. But as I said, promises for me are very, very important. So Alex actually called me last week, and I promised him that I was going to be on at 3:15, but the September 11th thing I'd actually forgot about it, and that you were going to be my guest. So Alex, I apologize for being very late. So very quickly, for our listeners, and we'll be able to continue on at another time. Let people know what it was that you called me about and see in the few minutes left if I'm able to say something substantial and meaningful that can hopefully make your day.
Well, you can hear me now?
Yes, absolutely. Hi. Sorry that I'm so late. It just...
No, it's okay. Maybe I can call next week or... but.
Yeah, definitely. But the issue was something.
But I've been listening to your show, and unfortunately, you see, the therapist that I have, he is like what he told me. He's like an emergency care counselor. He has a lot of people just come in there just to get signed paperwork. They got in trouble. He works a lot with people at the university, a lot of students that can't seem to stay off the, you know, the liquor. And he's like, you don't do anything like that. You come to session to try to improve yourself and make some changes. But my therapist is a completely, I'm sorry, incompetent.
And why are you continuing to see him if he's complete? And I trust what you're saying. There are plenty of incompetent therapists and healers around and in every profession. So what is it about Alex then? Again, no blaming, no judgment. Why are you putting yourself in a situation with an incompetent therapist?
I think I read a lot. I read many different authors, Tony Robbins, Power Subconscious Mind by Murphy, Think and Grow Rich, Tony Robbins, Bob Proctor. I read all different authors and try to get a real deep understanding. But I like to believe that at some level that there's something going on that I'm not aware of. But from an economical standpoint, I can't afford it anymore.
You've made your assessment about this therapist. You told me when we spoke last week that you'd seen him for a while, that you're not getting anywhere with him. So again, the question is why you or anybody would continue seeing a therapist or a dentist or a doctor or a lawyer who is incompetent.
Okay. All right. I see what you're saying. You want...
What do you think?
I understand what you're saying. You want people to be responsible. No one else is. Yes. Okay. So there's issues that I want to deal with, and I'm not dealing with it. And I found someone on some, you know, level that matches that. Law attraction. I don't know what you want to call it. But, yeah, you're saying what you're saying is true.
Right. So then the question is, you know, after we make our assessments, whether it's in a relationship, a personal relationship or a professional relationships, and our takeaway, we've tried, we spent some time is that, this is not working. This connection, for whatever reason, is not happening. Why then would you continue to go back and pay money when your takeaway is this is not helpful?
Because maybe on some level that I don't feel safe enough to go to someone that is going to listen to me, because again, a lot of things happen on an unconscious level. I see
Absolutely.
With my brother's kids, they do things for reasons they're not aware of, but they're just imitating their parents. So I believe on some level I picked him because that's how I got treated by my father, and my mother didn't do anything because she was passive.
So what to do? You've gotten a lot of, okay, it sounds to me, I'm sort of looking at the time here, and I think maybe we'll have to continue this conversation, because you're not alone at all, Alex, in you know, kind of repeating history, somebody who reminds you of your mother, father, whatever, where it really didn't work, and yet you continue to either attract or remain with people in your personal or professional life, you know, where it also doesn't work. But this is an issue. This is just something for you to work out, because you seem to know very clearly that this guy is not working for you, that it's not working. So you don't need to continue
on a path or on a trajectory that isn't working. You deserve to be with someone who you feel is really, really helpful. You deserve the best. You don't deserve to leave feeling disappointed.
But an issue of money, prior to the pandemic, I was paying him $40 per session. Now it's up to 50, 55. So if I go to another therapist, they'll be like, oh, at least 120 without insurance.
Well,
I'm like,
well,
okay, I'll see you maybe twice a year.
Yeah, no, I understand. And money, that's the American way. And this is, you know, something my husband and I were talking about. I mean, the lack of access to good mental health in part has to do, you're absolutely right, with people who don't have insurance, where, you know, therapist fees are exorbitant. But this guy who's charging you $50, he's not the only $50 therapist around. I mean, I would suggest calling, you know, an agency and getting a referral from somebody, you know, whether or not it would be the University Counseling Center or some, you know, counseling center, and at least go in and get a second opinion and get an evaluation, and hopefully the connection would be better with this person than it was with someone who you already know that the connection is not good and that he's not helping you. He's not the only game in town. And that's something that we all have to, we have to remind ourselves.
But
you know, if we're
isn't there on some level of responsibility or ethics through the therapist to say, listen, I'm neglecting you. His wife would sometimes pick up the phone and his wife told me, I don't like how he treats you.
Well,
what do you mean?
If she's involved, I'm not sure why a therapist's wife or, you know, spouse would be involved. But my advice to you is to do a little bit of research and find yourself a new therapist. I really do. Because you don't need to, you know, go along continuing to be frustrated and disappointed. You deserve to feel that you're getting help and that you're getting good help with someone who you like and trust, and who has the goods to be able to help you. So, I mean, in a way, you know, the tennis player that I am is saying to you, the ball is in your court. And the real question, and I think the ball is really in a lot of our courts, the real question is how are we going to play the next point? Are you going to continue to be sort of a victim of circumstances that, you know, is going to continue to frustrate and disappoint you? Are you at least willing to check out other mental health facilities and professionals where I'm sure you would find somebody competent who would be able to help you?
Yeah, I can, you know, but he's like, I've talked to other people that were former counselors, and now they're like, say, they are still licensed psychologists. One, you know, like a coach. She's
to do some
coached
research
by Tony Robbins. She's a certified coach by Tony Robbins School.
You need to do some research.
Why people are in counseling is because a lot of the therapists just string along, and it's just not,
believe me,
not just one.
Tell me about it. Don't get me going on American Mental Health. I am with you. Listen, we've got to run, and maybe we'll be able to continue this conversation. I'm very, very clear about this, Alex. Do some research and find yourself another therapist, okay? And I've got to go. All right, we'll maybe talk again. All right, everybody, listen, it is 3:58. It is amazing where the time goes every single week on the Speedy Show. And I want to leave you, because we have some beautiful music that I want to play as well. I want to leave you with my two weekly messages. The first, of course, is that we need to do everything possible. And Alex, I hope you're listening, that we're able to then live our lives in ways that are really in our best interest and with zero toxicity in terms of relationships, okay? Toxic relationships will invariably kill us in one way or another. And the other, especially, you know, commemorating September the 11th, we all need to do a much, 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 much better job in learning to love each other. So goodbye, everybody. Thank you, my wonderful producers. And let's hear the love song. And I'll talk with you all next week.